You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 25th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Marcia Chalatin, author of Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. Meanwhile, it's Infrastructure Week, part two, probably. The second deadline to vote on infrastructure set by Democratic leadership is October 31st, I think. It's fast approaching. And Manchin and Sinema's demands have become a bit clearer, but there are still a ways to go. Manchin is expressing concern over expanded Medicare benefits, which Bernie says it's staying in, so there could be an impasse there. And Sinema is holding fast on no increased tax rates for the wealthy and corporations. But in a twist, now she could be on board for the much less structural billionaires tax? I'm as confused as anyone. And just so people are aware, Medicare benefits on the chopping block, that expansion, that's political suicide. And I'm speaking the language to Democrats, that the only one they seem to listen to. The Supreme Court has again refused to immediately block Texas's near abortion ban. They're just going to wait a few weeks scheduling arguments for November 1st. What could go wrong? More documents are being revealed as a result of the Facebook whistleblower, which show the company repeatedly refused to heed calls for more action on misinformation and groups like QAnon from its own employees. And speaking of QAnon, Rolling Stone is reporting that the January 6th insurrectionists participated in, quote, dozens of meetings with members of Congress and White House officials ahead of the day, including Lauren Boebert, Louis Gohmert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and Paul Gosar, who reportedly offered the attempted insurrectionists a blanket pardon ahead of the day. And lastly, in Sudan, the military has seized power and taken Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok captive in an apparent coup. Thousands of protesters took to the street, but internet and phone lines were severely disrupted, likely an attempt by the military to get in the way of protests and demonstrations. All this and more on today's program. Oh, welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out today, although he will be coming to you from the past for a pre-recorded interview. He will be conducting the interview today, so you'll still get your dose of Sam. Not sure why you'd be interested in that when you have the Majority Report.
People are going through withdrawals at this point.
Exactly. But I mean, they don't know any better. They're used to him, and so soon I'll wake you all out of this spell that you've been put under by all the ums and ahs. Not that I haven't picked a little bit up of that myself. It's stunning how much I've picked up of that. And here are the tranches that we're going to get into today, including this clip of Ro Khanna here. So Representative Ro Khanna has been one of the more forceful progressives in the media, calling out Sinema and Manchin, and I think appreciated it. I think a lot of people here have appreciated it, because while it's a delicate situation, you still need the truth to be communicated with the public. And Ro Khanna has done that quite effectively. Here he is with Chris Wallace discussing this new development that Representative Sinema, or no, sorry, Senator Sinema is for some, I should call her that.
She's
right?
Sensitive about that.
Because she is sensitive about that. Exactly. Representative Congresswoman Sinema, just kidding, Senator Sinema, she's apparently on board for this billionaire's tax instead of any increase on corporations and the wealthy in terms of tax rates. Even though she voted against the Trump tax cuts, now she's against repealing them in order to pay for these new programs. But Khanna points all of this out in a conversation with Chris Wallace.
Wealthy Americans, those making more than $400,000, and on corporations, there is suddenly talk of a wealth tax on about 700 billionaires. Are you willing to vote for that without any real testing or vetting?
I do think a wealth tax makes sense, Chris. And as I mentioned, I think last time I was on, it would be paid largely by people in my district. Silicon Valley billionaires, our wealth has gone up 40% during the pandemic, $11 trillion of market cap in our area. They can afford to pay a wealth tax. But I guess my question for Senator Sinema is, she voted against the Trump tax cuts, and I just don't understand why she's not willing then to raise some of the rates back to what they were before the bill she voted against was, and she hasn't explained it to anyone.
But that was then. That's when we weren't in power. And now that we're in power, I have to wield it on behalf of the people that pay my bills.
And let's be real, it didn't need her vote, so it wasn't even really a question. If it needed her vote, maybe it would have been a different story.
Exactly. It's another example of why you can't trust where everybody votes, right?
It's not a window to the soul.
Yes, we had this conversation about Medicare for All, I recall, earlier in the year.
I like Chris Wallace. Like, you'd support a billionaire's tax without any vetting? Like, yes. Absolutely, 100% of the time, without even reading, like, past the first line. Like,
point
this is
blank.
A billionaire's test? Yes.
Because in a healthy society, billionaires should not exist, but they do. And so a small tax on their extra capital gains, it might even be what's liquid, is certainly something I would say yes to in 2 seconds without any vetting. But this is just like a reminder of how limited our politics are here. This is, of course, a part of Elizabeth Warren's idea. Right. It's downstream from her wealth tax concept. And that's fine as a supplement. But the fact that Sinema is embracing this goes to show that those kinds of proposals, you could call them technocratic, are very limited. And a comprehensive tax code that goes after the wealthy directly and under a large tent is a lot scarier to people, which is why Sinema is in favor of this. And it's not even going to raise a lot of money. Estimates are show that this billionaire tax will only raise a couple billion over 10 years. So it also sheds light on how much of this pay-for obsession is complete BS. We knew this already, but the veil that Sinema hides behind is that everything needs to be paid for, same with Manchin. This billionaire tax raises a lot less money than anything than repealing a lot of the Trump tax cuts would. So this is, I think, illustrative in a variety of ways. But, you know, I'm not picking on Warren here, but you can see the fork in the road between a kind of Sanders-like politics and a Warren-like politics here. And these are the kinds of proposals that get floated and that get approved when you just try to make well-intentioned tweaks to the system and ones that play well, right? It's not going to have any substantive effect. And because you have conservative Democrats like this who are insisting on these pay-fors, and there are a lot of conservative Democratic senators who are hiding behind Sinema and Manchin, like Mark Warner, who are happy to have them take the public heat, but actually oppose these kinds of things behind the scenes. We're not going to get a lot of the programs that we want. I mean, the climate provision has been whittled down to almost nothing because Joe Manchin has demanded that it be gone. And there are a lot of things that hang in the balance currently. We're unsure how it's going to play out, but this is where we're at. You can't even in today's Senate, when the Democrats control it, you can't even repeal the Trump tax cuts. And again, it is a failure of the Biden administration and the Democratic Party to not have been marketing this from the beginning as a way to repeal the Trump tax cuts. putting Trump in the title and drumming up that negative partisanship would have done wonders for this. And now Sinema and Manchin are just running the show.
We see it with the way that they say, certain Democrat will say, it's a shameful that Republicans are stopping in front of this measure still, was as they control Congress. Like, it doesn't work.
Yeah. There's nothing to hide behind. And so these kinds of things, and it's the same reason that Sinema could vote for vote against the Trump tax cuts and now support upholding them.
And it really is like the difference between Biden and FDR, and the FDR, like, we, like, hate me, like, whatever, like, I don't care if you guys don't support me, the economic royalists, as he called them. Biden, it is, like, people say that it was overinterpreted, the nothing will fundamentally change, but it wasn't. It was, he was speaking from the heart there, and whatever context you want to add to it, that fundamentally is what he meant.
Do you think that those think pieces about him being the next FDR might have been a little premature?
I think they were a currying favor.
Hmm. Well, I would happen to agree. All right, folks, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, you will be blessed by Sam Seder and this wonderful interview with Marcia Chalaton, author of Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. We will be right back. But first... Oh, I'm reading advertisements today. Yes, I am. So your home should show off what makes you, well, you, right? Joybird offers modern, customizable furniture for every space, available in a variety of vibrant, durable fabric options. And Joybird's fall sale is here. Now, I've said this before. I have seen Joybird's furniture on advertisements online. I'm moving soon, and I want to get some Joybird furniture, so I'm going to be taking advantage of this for sure, because it's really beautiful, the furniture itself. Choose from over 18,000 customization options or browse curated collections to find the perfect piece for your style. With Joybird's protection plan, your upholstery and leather pieces will always look as good as new. Joybird is committed to creating quality furniture and a more sustainable future. Pieces are made using responsibly sourced materials, free of harmful chemicals. Through partnerships with groups like One Tree Planted, Joybird is helping conservation efforts. With Joybird, you get quality craftsmanship, stain and scratch resistant fabrics, and limited lifetime warranty. Joybird stands by its quality with their 90-day returns, and it's if it's not everything you hope for, send it back. Now, look, I have seen the quality firsthand. We mentioned that there's a store where you can see Joybird pieces here in Brooklyn. Not super close, but you can walk through there. It's a part of a mall complex. And they are absolutely beautiful. I've been coveting and have had bookmarked a Joybird piece, and this fall sale is a perfect opportunity, including the usage of the Majority Report code. So create a space that brings you joy with Joybird. Visit joybird.com/majority and get 30% off your purchase. That's 30% off at joybird.com/majority. I absolutely will be checking that out in the near future. Now, this is the moment we've all been waiting for. I never thought this day would come, but... Is your butt clean enough to sit on the couch naked? No? Get a Tushy, the modern bidet that attaches directly to your toilet in under 10 minutes. Now, Sam has talked at length about how much he loves Hello Tushy, or Tushy, and how it's changed his life, and I believe him. The Tushy is the modern bidet for people who poop. Just poop, wash, and pat dry. The Tushy bidet washes your bum with water for a better clean than toilet paper, and washing with water is less irritating and more soothing for you anyway. The Tushy bidet is easy to install and attaches to the toilet in under 10 minutes. No electricity or plumbing needed. Using a Tushy bidet reduces your toilet paper by 80%, saving you money. It's eco-friendly and stylish, so everyone wants to save money. The Tushy is a way to invest in yourself and save you money in the future. So start washing with a Tushy bidet. For a better clean, go to hellotushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our viewers and listeners at hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. And you buy and install your Tushy, show it off, tag at HelloTushy on Instagram. It's a great, great way to post that butt picture that you've always been wanting to post and yet make it comedic. Right? No one wants to look like they're thirsty. This is a way to make it a lot more tongue-in-cheek. So again, you can tag at HelloTushy on Instagram. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping. All right, folks. Here is Sam's interview.
We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report, and joining me now is Marcia Chatelain. She is a professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, author of Franchise: The Golden Arches in Black America. Marcia, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, let's just start with. We should say that the book. Tracks, I guess you could say, the rise of black capitalism as a response by different sectors of society to the civil rights movement in the 60s in many respects. What first drew you to McDonald's as opposed to any other example or illustration of this dynamic?
Well, I wanted with Franchise to achieve two things. One, engage in a more nuanced conversation than the ones that I was currently hearing in the food justice movement about race, health disparities, and food access. Something that was moving away from the discourse that Black people were either ignorant or irresponsible in the way they fed themselves and their children, and they manifested that by consuming fast food. I wanted to interrupt that discourse. But the other thing that I wanted to really think about is the ways that in McDonald's entering Black communities immediately after Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, the ways that McDonald's in some parts of Black America had replaced the state, or I should say, from my perspective, what the state should be doing in providing, this idea that a McDonald's could provide the economic stability, could provide the first jobs, could double as the senior center, could be the place where kids play after school. What did it mean for a fast food restaurant to have so much outsized impact in Black communities? And how did we get there? And as the book unfolds and the book is, talking about the 1960s, but I think in many ways is so relevant today when we think about the responses to racial injustice from the corporate sector.
And we should say, we will get there in a moment, but the response of having businesses do what is desperately needed, or at least attempt to do what is desperately needed in many of these communities, is sort of like the perfect encapsulation of a neoliberal project here, where the market is going to take care of these things. I just want to start on that first part about, interrupting that question of nutrition and of McDonald's in these in Black communities, and that concept of like food deserts in some respect. What was it about that conversation that you felt like needed interrupting? That it was too limited and not
it was like super judgy, kind of racist. It was this idea that very well-intentioned and well-meaning people would say things like, if only people knew about growing and making kale, then we could actually, disrupt rates of hypertension and diabetes. And I think the two things about fast food that are often not acknowledged in these conversations, whether they come from the public health sector or the social justice sector, is that one, fast food is a practical choice for many Americans because it is cheap, because it is a lot of fuel very fast, because it's perfect if you're working two or three jobs. But more than anything else, that every relationship we have to food has to be nurtured. There has to be an introduction of the food. There's nothing kind of natural about this type of affinity that we often place between poor people, particularly poor people of color, and fast food, that this is a relationship that has to be structured. And I think that a lot of conversations around food justice and access, they'll say, well, there's no grocery stores. Okay, this is great. But once people have all this fresh food, can they pay their utility bills? Do they have time to prepare food? Where are their kids? Are they worried about them? You know, where are the elderly in this community? And so I just wanted us to take a step back away from the suggestion that if everyone had access to what we call good or quality or healthy food, then we would eradicate these problems that are based on diet, instead of looking at the larger structures like capitalism that will ultimately undermine our best efforts unless we start to think about where structures appear.
And I think, I think there's also a specific role that, at the very least, there was an attempt for this institution, I guess, of fast food to play in a lot of these communities. That was sort of, I guess, theoretically the idea on some level. And maybe we'll get to, you know, to what extent they're playing that role. But let's go back to, where we were. Let's do a history, a slight history of the development of fast food. Mm-hmm. Tell us that so that we have the context in which, what a shift it was in the wake of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in 1968, that era to move fast food into Black communities.
So in the early 1960s, you know, fast food, particularly fast food franchising, had such a like frenzy in the United States. Everyone wanted to replicate the success of McDonald's, which was the first publicly traded fast food company. McDonald's grows from Southern California and expands in highways and bedroom communities and suburbs. And Ray Kroc, who would create the franchise system that we have today, he says that McDonald's grows up in the suburbs. And suburbs means something in the early 1960s. But by 1968, two things are happening in the fact.
I mean, let's.
White, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the kind of audience that gets what I mean. But I'm going to say it means white people. It means white people who have disposable income.
And white people fled the cities.
And who have fled the cities because of what they perceive as urban decline. But it's about creating distance from particularly Black people, but also moving capital out of the cities. And so by the late 1960s, two things are happening. One, in some parts of the city where there is McDonald's, there is a big demographic shift from white to Black. And some white franchisees of McDonald's don't want to do business in those communities anymore, especially after, you know, many summers of racial unrest. The second thing that's happening is that after King's assassination, there are some real questions among the civil rights establishment as to what's our next move? Where's the pivot? We have seen great disappointment from the legislative and court victories since the 1950s. Schools are not integrated equally. We don't have equal access to public accommodations. And none of these things matter because there's such a wealth gap between Black and white in America that people who had been very much dedicated to the nonviolent struggle were saying, you know, maybe we need to start thinking about economics in a different way, not just the boycott, but getting a piece of the action. And so it's this like perfect storm after King's assassination, because the corporate sector is seeing that they need to be responsive to the fact that they've excluded so many people. And then the civil rights movement, establishment, is actually moving away from King's vision of thoughtful analysis of poverty and capitalism and saying, if we're not going to get our fair share, maybe we start opening businesses. And at the same time, the franchise model is being endorsed by, you know, everyone as this kind of get rich quick scheme. So it's this like perfect moment. I mean, it's so much like today in so many ways, where we have this kind of speculative economy. We also have this incredibly, like, you know, this second Gilded Age. And then we have these corporations and other institutions that are trying to respond to racial unrest. And it comes in the form of, we know the answer, McDonald's and Black communities.
So, all right, wait. So I want to take those two ends of the equation, I guess, which would be, you know, the sort of corporate America's response to, we have multiple major urban centers, you know, going through uprisings and destruction of property. And then in the wake of the death of Martin Luther King, a shift within at least some elements of the civil rights movement to less of a critique of capital and more of a sense of like, well, maybe we need to get power within the context of the system rather than talk about changing it. So from the corporate side, I think you raised the issue of disaster capitalism. Like this is
100%.
This is the intention is less about what can we do for racial relations in this country and more about how can we exploit an opportunity that exists. And also perhaps, I mean, the instance of Jones, I believe his name was the Ronald Jones. Like that, like how much? So tell the story of Ronald Jones.
Yep.
And then also so there's like these two elements I think that you talk about is the disaster capitalism situation where it's like we can move in here and get some, you know,
market share.
And then the other part is maybe this is also like we can get some protection on one flank or another.
So, right. So after King's assassinated, Roland Jones is a manager at a McDonald's in Washington, D.C., and he is seeing D.C., particularly the U Street corridor, you know, going up in flames. And he is asked by McDonald's to kind of go to Chicago to recruit the first Black franchise owner. And it's this kind of this perfect convergence of how disaster capitalism works, right? You have the initial shock event of King's assassination, one of, you know, a number of political assassinations that happens in the 60s. You have the deep confrontations between everyday people and the police, right? The kind of law and order stuff that is going to unfold. And then you have this corporation that is trying to protect its restaurants, not just because it's their restaurants, but they own the property in which those restaurants are built. McDonald's is one of the largest landowners in the United States because they own their real estate. And so you also have these white franchise owners who are doing business that is either in Black communities or too close. And they're saying, we don't want this. And so this is a process that is like mirrors so much of the horrors of the real estate sector where there's like white flight, the movement of capital and the movement of tax dollars. But McDonald's is not just saying we want to respond to the needs of the Black community. They are also going to be supported by a Nixon administration that is giving federal funds for minority owned businesses. And at this time, franchises are considered small businesses. And they also will have the endorsement of major civil rights organizations that I think are exhausted and irritated by the failures that they saw throughout the 60s, whether it was on racial integration or the war on poverty. And they're going to start talking about business ownership. And this is the place in which Black self-determination will be realized. And so you have these kind of two impulses. And the thing about business as a strategy for either racial inclusion or to suppress racial unrest, it captivates people on the left and the right. Because people on the left will say, well, I guess Black self-determination and Black power is important. So owning your business is good. And then people on the right love this because if you build Black communities, no one will say, wait a second, but there's a white community here that's getting more tax dollars, more infrastructure, better quality housing and better schools. It's this desire to build within hyper-segregated environments and keep everyone quiet.
I want to take that last part second here and go back, because I was surprised about the Nixon administration offering this, because in many respects they were running on the idea that, like, hey, we got a problem with the black people in this country, and we can't quite say it exactly like that, but the idea that they would then extend these small business loans, like, what was behind that? I mean, what, like, was that a was that out of fear by the Nixon administration? Was it out of some type of lobbying effort for businesses that are like, well, wait a sec, this is, I mean, that dynamic reminds me a little bit of the for-profit college business, where it is, we're going to have government essentially fully subsidizing, like, and by I mean fully subsidizing these for-profit universities. 90-95% of their revenue comes from government loans. And more often than not, black people, particularly black women, end up being the conduit of that money sort of passing through to these companies. I mean, was that like what was going on here? This dynamic of, this is a way for us to sort of give money to business in this country and to have it sort of just, you know, pass through the black community. And so that we have, you know, sort of everybody bought into this notion of this sort of government largesse, as opposed to, like, let's build schools.
Let's distribute taxes. You know, this happens a little bit earlier, and it kind of has its, like, high point with Nixon. So prior to King's assassination, he writes a letter to the Johnson administration, and he says, hey, these war on poverty funds that you earmarked for early child education, why are they going to business development? Why is this becoming part of the vision of how you eradicate poverty? And so this idea of allowing black people access to own a business, this is a response as early as 65 to Watts. It's this kind of like Ford Foundation meets, you know, Office of Economic Opportunity way of envisioning. One, I think the restoration of, like, patriarchy. If black men own something, then they would be less likely to destroy it in their neighborhood. So there's some logics about ownership. And then the second part of it is that, you know, corporations like Xerox and IBM, they are kind of leading the way in what we would call diversity strategies today. And they're seeing some possibility of government subsidies for doing business with what will later be determined minority-owned businesses. And then there's a designation women-owned businesses. So all of this is to say that, like, this idea that you can get people to have more respect or value their community if they own something in it has long been a response to when there is this moment. But what I always find fascinating about it is that people do not take to the streets because they don't own businesses. They do it because the police have killed someone and there's no accountability. They do it because there's nowhere to live safely. They do it because, you know, there are all of these material conditions that aren't being met. So all of this is to say Nixon enters the chat because, you know, in 68, it's kind of weird to think about it. The Republican Party has completely shifted its strategy and its audience, but they still have a few black voters.
Right.
They still have a few people who are party loyalists. You know, they still have people like Jackie Robinson who are willing, you know, to try to fight till the end for the Republican Party. And what they have are a lot of black men celebrities who are endorsing Nixon because of this platform. You have Wilt Chamberlain, you have James Brown, you have all of these people who say, like, okay, Nixon is probably garbage, but I'll mess with him if he's going to give us some business loans. And this is important for Nixon in order to solidify some key places that we would call swing states now.
And we should also say, too, I would imagine that there is a significant part of the liberal mindset that is coming out of, like, the Moynihan Report.
900%.
And that is this notion of, like, if we can somehow change the culture of black people, and part of that would be, like, the idea that we have these entrepreneurs in black communities and have people invested in their own success. And I would also imagine, too, like, around that time is a big push against this idea of more social reform. We're coming out of Medicare and we're watching like the Powell memo. I mean, that's generated at that time. There's a real sort of concern about government actually like sort of providing
care for people. You know, and there's something more palpable about a small business loan versus direct cash payments to the poor. And so, you know, that has always been an evergreen part of American politics. And so, you know, so if you get kind of black business to operate and to work, then you can undermine all of the social safety networks that people, everyday people will use and more people will use. And, you know, Nixon, I interviewed the son of a guy named Brady Keyes, who starts a series of fried chicken restaurants in the 1960s. He was on the Pittsburgh Steelers. And his son said to me, he said, my dad wasn't a Republican, but Richard Nixon called him up and said, open up one of your restaurants in Cleveland so that when I go on a campaign stop, I can point to black voters on what I did. And this guy got upwards to $9 million in federal and private funds to get into fast food franchising. And so, you know, these types of anecdotes start to stand in for actually like real substantive policy, because this is a dazzling, you know, example of what the Nixon administration is willing to do for black people.
And I'm also fascinated about the, you know, about Frank Abernathy, who followed Martin Luther King in the Southern Baptist Leadership Convention,
the Southern Christian, yeah,
Southern Christian, sorry, and he was more, I think, explicitly for a socialist agenda than King was. I mean, what was the not necessarily the totality, but where were the different sort of forces within the black civil rights movement as to this as a solution to black empowerment?
Yeah, this is such an interesting moment. I've started doing some research for another book on this question of like what happens, you know, April 5th, 68, when everyone's putting their head together about what's going to happen next. So King felt, and Ralph Abernathy were associates from the Montgomery bus boycott years. They were, you know, they kind of grew up together in the movement, and he adored him. But, you know, Abernathy is just saying kind of what is in his gut. You know, King in his last year is talking against the Vietnam War. He's critiquing the war on poverty. He's talking about, you know, militarism and materialism and racism as three evils. Like he is going out on a kind of a left junket by himself. And what alienated him from a lot of his colleagues was his anti-military stance, because so many African Americans during this period of time are making the case for civil rights based on their World War II participation. So he's kind of upsetting some of the people who had participated in the military, you know, and his critique of capitalism is really layered, because he said, you know, we did the boycotts, but what we're also doing is the labor struggle. And regardless of whether you're a laborer, like the sanitation workers he went to support in Memphis when he was killed, we all have to feel the pain somehow. And so he started a project through SCLC called Operation Breadbasket that Jesse Jackson was in charge of. And Jesse Jackson was doing this thing where he was pressuring businesses in black communities to not only do better service, but to actually hire local people. And that will be his blueprint into the 70s and 80s that becomes corporate negotiation. So it isn't just everyone don't shop at the store, but don't shop at the store. And then how many black lawyers are you going to hire? How many black construction workers are you going to hire? And so what started as this idea of kind of economic accountability spins out into kind of corporate partnership that really loses kind of sight of, you know, what King was really getting at. And that was the economic exploitation of workers. And so Ralph Abernathy is not considered as like elegant and as suave. You know, people in the New York Times say that he's like totally vulgar, and how dare he like try to be the next king. And he does things like he wears an armband that says, you know, Mississippi goddamn, and everyone's like, King would never do that. You know, he's just in the worst position ever because he will never be Martin Luther King. But he's more blunt, and he says, you know, this black capitalism thing, it's not going to serve us. We need black socialism. But even within a few years of him saying that, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is also kind of partnering with some of the franchises. And a lot of people who graduate from the movement, they reappear in my book as franchise owners or supporters of Black McDonald's franchisees.
Was that just sort of like an exhaustion? Sort of like, I mean, because I'm also struck by around that time you write about the Black Panther Party in, I think it was in Oregon.
In Portland.
They're exercising their power within that to sort of, you know, force franchisees there to sort of share their largesse with the community. And there's all this sort of like attempts to exert power or to grow power or to build the community. And it feels like some people were just like, if you can't beat them, join them type of situation.
Or ask them for something. So there are these really precious years in the 1970s where McDonald's is trying to, on one hand, capitalize on the black dollar and market to black people, tell them they can come to McDonald's and, you know, be themselves and try to be culturally relevant. And they're still trying to kind of draw a line of how many demands from local black organizations they're going to actually indulge. And so when the Black Panther Party says, you know, you have to give to our free breakfast program, you're here, we're here, you know, the person refuses. And, you know, there's this question of whether the Panther Party bombs the McDonald's. There's still a lot of questions about that. But, you know, the issue is like, who are you going to be in our community? And the way that they address this is by having very structured understanding of what that is. It's giving to the United Negro College Fund. It's giving to the NAACP. It's showing that they have black franchise owners. And, you know, while McDonald's is becoming a fact of life in black America, it's not the seamless process. It's a lot of people having questions about the structure of the business. Does it even matter if a McDonald's is black franchised, if only one person becomes a millionaire? Like the quality of the experience, it's all up for grabs. And this is what I love about this period of time, because we know how the story ends, but the process and the questions that people ask, I think reminds us that, you know, like we don't have to concede to corporate power immediately, that there's a give and take in the whole process that I think that, you know, we have to remind ourselves of.
Let's talk about where the story sort of ends or goes from there. So you have this, these federal funds that come in that essentially provide for the establishment of these franchises, McDonald's, but other fast food. Mm-hmm. And then what in the theory is what about what it's going to do for the community, or at least that's what is it that they're saying that's going to happen? And how long does it take to realize, wait a second, that's not happening? Or does it not happen?
Well, I mean, you know, it's all trickle down economics. And it's this idea that if you have a black franchise McDonald's in a community, then the person who franchises that location will engage in less employment discrimination. And so black youth will have jobs, and those jobs will become the, you know, stepping stone for stable economic lives, that they will make a lot of money and donate to black institutions. And here you have this thing that's taking care of people. You know, by the early 70s, two things become clear. One, that the devastating kind of condition of business districts in predominantly black areas allows McDonald's to make tons of money. And the second thing that becomes clear is, even within a system that says it's going to create black millionaires, those black millionaires are still like aggrieved racial parties, which I think I did not write a book so that we could be like really sympathetic towards millionaires. And at the same time, it is really messed up the way that like you see these black franchise owners who are bought in and they're still navigating a system in which, because they are black, they know they could be making more, but they're not. And the weight of kind of what's going to happen to the community is falling on people who are running a fast food restaurant. And so I think by the early 70s, the racial disparity in the franchise opportunity system becomes very clear. By the 1980s, it also becomes very clear that these jobs are not a leverage. They are not just for teenagers, that we have a working poor that are dependent on fast food jobs for their basic needs, and that these jobs are insufficient. And so as the 80s are ramping up, you have more and more of these protests by people like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton through their organizations that are pushing for more Black franchise owners, but are not leveraging their political power to change the conditions of workers. And this is where I really get stuck, you know, in the kind of speculative alternative history. What if the campaigns were about workers and the quality of their jobs, rather than this idea that the goal is to make more Black millionaires and their millions will trickle down to everyone else?
I mean, am I cynical in thinking that there was like that wasn't a question? There wasn't just two questions there. Like the third option is that those people who were pushing for the development of those Black millionaires weren't just looking for the trickle down, but also as a way of like enhancing the power of their organizations.
900%, because this is what helps the NAACP after the 1970s, because they're super struggling as an organization. They're being sued by a lot of the racists that they sued in the 50s and 60s. They're losing membership. They're losing kind of appeal to youth because of the growth of Black power and the disillusionment with civil rights organizations. And so they come up with a strategy called Fair Share that comes out of the Los Angeles branch. And that's the idea of selective boycott. They do it at Coors because Adolph Coors, you know, says bananas things like, you know, slavery wasn't that bad. It was kind of a good idea. And, you know, all of these companies that are doing what companies do, you know, they're targeting them, and their terms of negotiations open up the pathway for Black people in white collar and elite positions. For the most part, it enhances the deposits in white banks. It creates all sorts of contracts for white Black insurance agencies and advertising agencies, but it never gets to the heart of the critical mass of workers in any of these industries.
It also feels to me that if I'm owning a franchise in a, in any area, to a certain extent, I mean, it's possible that my intentions are, I want to raise the wages of the, within the community. But, it seems to me that, like, you know, from a business standpoint, I'm not, it's not rocket science to take a bun and put it on here. And I don't want the wages to go up too much in this community, that it is actually not in my best interest for more businesses to be built around my McDonald's or, whatever it is, because if there are more businesses here, then I'm going to have more competition for my labor. And so everybody's got to eat. And so, they're going to spend their money on their electric bill or their gas bill, and then they're going to buy food and maybe clothes, but I don't need a lot of business to be going on here for me to make my money when I'm in the business of selling low-cost food.
Well, I mean, talk about all sorts of kind of perverse motivations, because on one hand, archetypically, the Black business owner has been the anchor of Black communities, you know, since the 19th century. It was the guy who owned the funeral home, the family that owned the bank, when they were, when they were servicing Black consumers who had zero options, right? And then they were doing other things like lending money or establishing scholarships. This has not changed that much. But one of the things that I think is fascinating, you know, after the George Floyd summer, all of these ridiculous calls for more Black businesses, I was like so grumpy because I couldn't believe all of the bad ideas of the past were being recycled for this moment, in which I think that there's incredible clarity in movements, like abolish and defund, like Black Lives Matter, about like what the terms of engagement are. But the response becomes, more Black creators on Etsy or more Black furniture makers or, you know, 5% of contracts for this clothing company will come from Black designers. That's great. This does nothing to actually address any of the things that people are asking for, or demanding, or dying for. But this idea that the Black business can then do these things is also such a setup for failure. The majority of Black businesses in the United States do not employ anyone, are these kind of sole proprietor, one person, maybe one family setups. This idea that you're going to open all of these businesses and they'll be in the position to pay the living wage, to have really robust benefits, to, you know, invest in the community, it's just, it's not real. And this is where I start to think about, you know, these franchise owners, some of them made a lot of money, but, you know, there was a recent lawsuit among 50 plus Black franchise owners against McDonald's. They're alleging the things that I write about in my book from the 70s, that there's this disparate way in which they have to operate. And the weight of doing businesses in the particular communities that they're often put in is also something that is kind of, you know, not sustainable for their businesses. So if it's happening with a McDonald's franchise, how the hell is a Black-owned boutique or bookstore going to carry the weight of complete, you know, structural racism as well as government negligence?
Well, can you talk a little bit about the how those Black franchise owners are, what the nature of the lawsuits are, and like what the dynamics are that put them under the gun? Which, of course, you know.
You know, I mean, come on.
Well, yes, but I mean, but be explicit about that for us. Mm-hmm. But also, we should also say that to the extent that there's any of those people who do have designs on building up their community, that kind of pressure also decreases the opportunity for them to do that, even if we're not so jaundiced about their intentions to do so.
Absolutely. So what they allege is that McDonald's has been engaging in a practice in which when a Black franchise owner is to be assigned a store, they are assigned stores in predominantly Black areas that have a low economic base. And as a result, the carrying costs of doing business in those communities are unusually higher relative to their white peers who are often assigned in places in the suburbs and predominantly white areas. And one of the things that the franchise owners from the 70s would talk about is to say that we make more money than the white stores, but our carrying costs are higher because of security, usually taxes because they're in major urban areas, as well as the fact that Black franchise owners often inherited stores that were in poor condition and had a lot of broken equipment. McDonald's is also, it's not only a real estate company, it's also, you know, an object lesson in supply chain. So if I franchise a McDonald's and you have a tomato farm and we're friends and I say, hey, can you give me a deal on tomatoes? I can't do that, right? There's certain suppliers and there's certain mechanisms, and there's also certain demands that a franchise owner has to meet. And so when things that are supposed to make fast food attractive are introduced, all day breakfast, unlimited soda, Wi-Fi, touchscreens, the McCafe, all of those types of upgrades are the responsibility of the franchisee in order to be competitive and compliant. And Black franchisees will say, we can't do those things and still make money, or we can't do those things and still keep up with our rent payments. And so what they are saying is a lot of the things that we see in the real estate market, that there's redlining, that there is assignment and steering into certain communities. And as a result, that Black franchise owners are more vulnerable to losing their stores.
Where are we today on these kind of debates or questions? I mean, it sort of feels like we're not necessarily in a great place.
No, we are not. And, you know, this is where I start wagging my finger at everyone. Folks, businesses, I guess, are fine. I guess someone can sell something and people can buy things in markets. I've already given up the fact that I'm not going to win this fight against capitalism by saying that maybe we don't need markets. Okay, fine, we have markets. But markets should not be tied to the well-being and the viability of people. And so, you know, we are still in the age of bad ideas. We're still in the age of Black-owned businesses are something that we put resources in, or the illusion of resources in, at the detriment or the expense of thinking about the fact that we actually have a robust public system to draw funds from, and we can provide people with the things that they need. You know, sometimes when I'm on the road with my book, someone will say, well, what do you think the solution is? And I'll say, I can answer all of these questions, right? Like, what do we do about racial injustice? Is it, this is where we start. Free college, Medicare for all, free childcare. Let's start there. These aren't even like the most radical of ideas. Let's start there. No one has to take diversity training. No one has to be more sensitive. I'm not going to even ask you to be less racist. I'm just going to ask for things that are not tied to employment and also things that everyone can get so they can make decisions free and clear. Because one of the great dangers of thinking we can kind of start up or innovate our way out of racial injustice is that it's not only untrue, but then it makes people even more vulnerable to the whims of people who say, here's this, you know, shiny object. This is what is going to answer our questions. And it's a great strategy because it never forces us to say, wait a second, don't we have a robust public system in which these things can actually happen? So, you know, the sleight of hand continues. I think the grift continues. And we are, unfortunately, in this moment, both with the George Floyd summer and COVID-19, where I think the floodgates and the disaster capitalism, we already see it manifesting.
Indeed. Marcia Chatelain, the professor of history, African-American studies at Georgetown, author. The book is Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We are back. Wonderful interview that Sam conducted there. Always appreciate getting sorry, go on.
I'm a big fan of the final prescription that she gave at the end there. The free healthcare, free higher education, and childcare.
Yeah.
Simple.
Exactly. Before we head out, let's just check in on President Biden here. So, these, as I mentioned, it's Infrastructure Week 2.0. Biden is set to travel to Europe on Thursday to meet with Pope Francis and then go to the COP, or COP26, I forget exactly how you say it, in Glasgow. So he was asked here about the status of the infrastructure fight and whether or not he expects a vote this week. Here's what Biden had to say.
It went well. A few more things to work out, but it went well.
Do you think you'll have a plan before Wednesday?
With the grace of God and the goodwill of neighbors.
Do you want a plan, a deal by the time you leave for COP? Is that something you've expressed to Democrats?
That's my hope.
Do you expect to vote this week?
What do you think? I don't know.
We're asking you.
Are you concerned if you have to leave without your...
It'd be very, very positive to get it done before the trip. Thank you.
All right. Well, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what to make of it, but when you pair it with Manchin's current comments, he believes that there will be a deal on the, quote, conceptual framework of the package this week. Now, are Democrats going to vote to advance the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which has been waiting in the wings because it was supposed to be paired with the larger reconciliation package, which is now going to be significantly whittled down? Manchin is still saying that he's sticking to that $1.5 trillion figure arbitrarily, although behind the scenes, apparently, there's a little bit more flexibility there. I mean, my estimate is that's going to be around $1.8 trillion, which is insane.
Manchin also said he wants the PRO Act and something like $4.5 trillion like several months ago. So he just says things.
Oh, he just says things, exactly. And it's arbitrary. And the idea that you can just like make a determination based on a number is ridiculous. But the fact that he's saying that publicly, that he believes there will be that framework, and the fact that Biden is also indicating a similar sentiment as he's set to leave for Europe at the end of this week on Thursday-ish, means that there could be something that happens. A deal could be struck at some point. But it's going to be a shell of itself. And it already is a shell of itself. And Manchin and Sinema have run this show, and I think that's obvious for people. but they have been able to deliver for the people that provide them with campaign contributions, because there is a real chance that unless Bernie and progressives hold firm on Medicare benefit expansion for vision, hearing, and dental, that that could be struck from the bill. And I wouldn't even vote on this without the entire bill agreed to, not just the framework, because there's still a lot of wiggle room there. But I'm not sure that with all of this external pressure that Jayapal can keep her caucus together on this, and certainly Schumer's not going to do anything in the Senate. So stay tuned. But that is all the time that we have for today. We will see you tomorrow, Peacock audience. But for those of you who are sticking around, we have an entire fun half filled with fun just for all of you. Matt, what's happening over on Left Reckoning?
Oh, Elias Cepeda, we talked about a couple of things. Colin Powell, remembering Colin Powell, talked about the issue teachers face. We also talked about actually Kyrie Irving a little bit. And, but in a way, kind of, look, just to, I guess, preview the conversation a little bit, I think Kyrie's absolutely wrong, obviously. Jonathan Isaac also wrong. But at a certain point, you have to look at how this plays to the non-COVID fan or sports fan, the people who aren't sort of, and by which I mean a little bit glib, but like following the news terribly closely. And it's not Kyrie Irving's responsibility to get the pandemic under control. But we're also going to be talking about the...
well, we can touch on that when we talk
what's
about
going on.
What happened at Barclays Center over
the
weekend.
In the fun half here, yeah. So,
in the fun half.
But go subscribe to the YouTube channel, folks. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning for all the for that Sunday conversation. But also, it's free to subscribe to YouTube.
Right. Definitely. Please do that. And check out Noam Key Show as well. Lots of stuff. No. I'm not even going to attempt it. JustCoffee.coop. Check out their site. I need to get a little bit more cold brew from them. My favorite cold brew blend. We will also be taking your calls and reading your IMs. I already have seen a few messages about my ad raid. 646-257-3920. We will see you in the fun.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
Dude.
You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.